sensation. Every time I pick up the newspaper or a magazine, there's another article. I just think, brilliant review. And I even see it in the airport. And I met Jan 10 years ago when her debut novel, Big Food for Millionaires, also a bestseller, came out, and we became fast friends. Jan went to Yale and attended law school. After working as a lawyer for several years, she became a full-time writer and has received numerous prizes and awards, and her picture has been featured in many places. She has written articles on books, travel, and food, which have appeared in many magazines and newspapers, and she has lectured widely about writing, politics, and film. From 2007 to 2011, she lived in Tokyo, Japan, and now she lives in New York City with her family. Pachinko, Minjin's lyrical, gorgeous, and haunting novel, tells the tale of the overlooked history of the ethnic Koreans in Japan. Like a 19th century novel, the reader is swept away into this 100-year family saga describing the brutal life of Koreans in Japan. It makes us care deeply about her characters. The London Times described it as expansive, elegant, and utterly absorbing. When I was reading The Galley, I got the feeling that I used to get at Books and Company once every couple of years, almost a toe-tingling experience. I was like, oh, this is really good book. This is good. And then I would have put it in the window in a huge pile, put it by the cash register. Everyone would have had to buy it, and would sell a lot of copies. Anyway, now let us welcome you into the room.
She's one of my very first, I want to say, like, artistic patrons. So before we became friends, she actually treated me like a writer even before I published. So I don't think she knew that she was my patron, but because she always treated me as a writer, even before I deserved to be called a writer, I found that to be so important because she actually knew writers. Like, real life. She had that really incredible bookstore for Whitney, the former Whitney uptown. And then she had a second bookstore where I finally met her. I remember one day I walked in and Gloria Sun was standing right next to her and she goes, Gloria, you must meet Min, she's a writer. I'm like, and that's how I met Gloria Sun. But thank you, Jeanette, for having me here today. And it means so much to me to be in conversation with Jeanette, because Jeanette is an incredible writer herself. Her book is coming out this year, a memoir, and it's going to be a glorious triumph, and I can't wait to share that book with everybody here. I'm going to read a tiny bit of my novel, Pachinko, and I'm going to read a tiny bit because I always read short, I want you to like me. The author who goes on. I'm reading a section which is sort of timely about citizenship. And the headlines that we see today are really not recognizable to me. In my experience, as a naturalized American citizen, this is a great country that is very welcoming of foreigners. I'm going to read a scene that takes up almost at the latter part of the book in 1976 in Yokohama. And there are three characters in the scene. There is Moses, who is my main character, Sanja's son, who owns a pachinko parlor, and he's very well off. And then we also have his son, Solomon, and it's his 14th birthday. And we also have Moses' girlfriend, Etsuko, who is a Japanese citizen. So we have three persons, and they're at a government office. It's 6 minutes tops. I try to time it with, like, basically a little longer than a YouTube video. The Yokohama ward office was a giant gray box. with an obscure sign. The first clerk they saw was a tall man with a narrow face, with a shock of black hair buzzed off at the sides. And he stared at Etsko shamelessly, his eyes darting across her breasts, her hips, and her jeweled fingers. She was overdressed compared to Moses and to Solomon, who wore white dress shirts and dark slacks and black dress shoes. They looked like the gentle Mormon missionaries who used to glide through her village on their bicycles when she was a girl. "Your name?" The clerk squinted at the form that Solomon was filling out. "Solomon, what kind of name is that?" "It's from the Bible. He was a king and the son of David, and he was a man of great wisdom. My great uncle named me." And the boy smiled at the clerk as if he were sharing a secret. He was a polite boy, but because he had gone to school with Americans and other kinds of foreigners at his international schools, he sometimes said things that a Japanese person would never have said. "Solomon, king, great wisdom. Koreans don't have kings anymore." "What did you say?" Etsko asked. And quickly, Moses pulled her back. And she glanced at Moses. His temper was far worse than hers. Once, when a restaurant guest had tried to make her sit with him, Moses, who happened to be there that night, walked over, picked him up bodily, and threw him outside the restaurant, breaking the man's ribs. And she was expecting no less of a reaction now. But Moses averted his eyes from the clerk, and he stared at Solomon's right hand. And Moses smiled. "Excuse me, sir. We're in a hurry to return home because it's the boy's birthday. Is there anything else that we can do? Thank you very much for understanding." And confused, Solomon turned to Etsko and she flashed him a warning look. And the clerk pointed to the back of the room and told Moses and Etsko to sit down. And Solomon remained standing opposite the clerk. And in the long rectangular room, shaped like a train car, with bank teller windows running parallel along opposite walls, half a dozen people sat on benches, reading their newspapers or manga. And Etsko wondered if they were all Korean. And Moses sat down, and then he got up again. And he asked if she wanted a can of tea from the vending machine. And she nodded yes. She felt like slapping the clerk's face. In middle school, she had once slapped a gossipy girl, and it had been very satisfying. When Moses returned with their tea, she thanked him. "You must have known. You must have warned him, didn't it?" And after the words came out, they sounded harsh, and she felt sorry. "No, I didn't say anything to him." And he opened and he closed his fist rhythmically. "I came here with my mother and my brother Noah, with my first registration papers, and the clerk was normal, nice even. So I asked you to come. I thought maybe having a woman, a Japanese woman, buying him might help." And he exhaled through his nostrils. "It was stupid to wish for kindness." "No, no, no, you couldn't have warned him. I shouldn't have said it like that. It is hopeless. I cannot change his fate. He is Korean, and he has to get those papers, and he has to follow all the steps of the law perfectly. Once, at a ward's office, a clerk told me that I was a guest in his country. You and Solomon were born here." "Yes, my brother Noah, too, was born here." And Moses covered his face with his hands. "Anyway, the clerk wasn't wrong. And this is something that Solomon must understand. We can be deported. We have no motherland. And life is full of things he cannot change or control. So he must adapt because my boy has to survive. And Solomon returned to them. Next, he had his photograph taken, and afterwards, he had to go to another room to get fingerprinted, and then they could go home. The last clerk was a pretty woman with a long ponytail, and she took Solomon's left index finger and gently dipped it into a pot filled with thick black ink, and Solomon depressed his finger onto a white card as if he were a child painting. And Moses looked away, and he sighed audibly. The clerk told him to pick up the registration card in the next room. "Let's get your dog tags," Moses said. And Solomon faced his father. "It's what we dogs must have." And the clerk looked furious suddenly. "The fingerprints and the registration cards are vitally important for government records. There's no need to feel insulted by this. It is an immigration regulation required for foreign." And Edsko stepped forward. "But you don't make your children get fingerprinted on their birthday, do you?" And the clerk's neck turned red. "My son is dead." And Edsko bit her lip. She didn't want to feel anything for the woman, but she knew what it was like to lose your children. It was like you were cursed, and nothing would ever restore that desolation in your life. "Koreans do a lot of good things for this country," Edsko said. "They do the difficult jobs the Japanese don't want to do, and they pay taxes and obey laws, they raise families, and they create jobs. Ukraine's always tell me that." And Solomon blurted out, "She's not Korean." And Edsko touched his arms. And the three of them walked out of the building. And she wanted to crawl out of the gray box and see the light of outdoors again. She longed for the white mountains of Hokkaido. And though she had never done so in her childhood, she wanted to walk in the cold, snowy forests, beneath the flanks of the dark, leafless trees. In life, there was so much insult and injury, and she had no choice but to collect what was hers. But now, she wished to take Solomon's shame and add it to her pile, though she was already so overwhelmed. Thank you. Because of its pride in monoracial, in its monoracial identity. For those who don't fit into a middle class monoracial identity, it is a very difficult path. And by that I mean, you could be Japanese and you could be disabled and that person has a hard life. So it isn't just your ethnic identity. It's that if you don't fit into a certain norm which agrees with the principles of law or harmony, it's a really tough path.
So how would you say express?
You know, it's funny because I was insulated by privilege. So my husband had a fancy job, and that's one of the reasons why we went to Japan. And so we had an apartment that was paid. for, private schools that were paid for. So in many ways, like, we had a kind of ease because we're in this sort of bubble. However, now and then, in certain situations, a person would point out that I was Korean and I had this crazy, angry Korean blood. So for example, we went to this really lovely church in Japan, which is Tokyo Union Church, a great church. And once a month, because we had nothing better to do, not because we're nice, we volunteered to serve the homeless. And we served curry to the Japanese homeless. There's a huge Japanese homeless population in Japan. And one day, I had this sort of bright idea, and I told the committee on serving the homeless, maybe we could pay the guys who work in the kitchen $10 an hour. So it's $30 for that once a month. Because these guys had to carry, these Japanese men had to carry these humongous bags of metal and tin from the Coke bottles and recyclables. And I thought, well, we have the money. We could probably pay $90 once a month to these guys who carry all these things. And I said this thinking that I'm helping the Japanese homeless. And I remember this really lovely Japanese man, truly a great guy, said to me, "You Koreans are always complaining. It's that Korean blood of yours." And this is one of the hardest things, I think, when you are a minority, is that you can have an amazing person, and then once in a while they have these statements. And you're like, and you don't, and I'm 48 years old. I've seen a lot at this point. And you just can't, like, write people off because they say something stupid. Or, like, it would be extremely lonely if you are constantly writing people off. And also, I kind of hope that people don't write me off when I write something, say something stupid, because I invariably will. I might tonight. So it was like this really, you know, that kind of thing happened enough times that even though I would forget, it would be reminded. Mm-hmm. So that happened.
So interesting. Now, you write a lot about religion in the book, and especially Christianity. So please tell us how that relates to Korean history.
Oh, and also about your upbringing. Oh, absolutely. So my grandfather was Presbyterian minister, and he ran an orphanage after the war, and because there were so many orphans after the war, and in this orphanage, he had people teach these little boys and girls how to make pianos. So today, if you go to Korea and you play a piano, that piano has some history to my grandfather's orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
I know, kind of cool, right? So 20th century history in Korea really cannot be understood without understanding its intersection with how missionaries functioned in Korea. The Yi dynasty was absolutely clear about certain things that were very anti-democratic. They did not believe in the education of girls. They did not believe in breaking down class structure. So whatever your feelings are about Christianity or missionaries, and I understand if people feel skeptical about cultural imperialism, one of the things that I personally agree with in terms of cultural imperialistic policies is I believe in the education of women. So I don't believe that all cultures are relative. Like, I'm against things like genital mutilation. And I'll be very clear about that. But going back to Christianity, which is so important in understanding Korean history, it infuses everything. Like, every major university in Korea has its history in missionaries. So whatever your feelings are, it's just part of 20th century Korean history. And also, the most important thing is, the chief architects who designed its uprisings against the Japanese occupation of Korea were all ministers. So it's very similar to the 1960s civil rights movement orchestrated by ministers.
And was it hard for your family when all of you arrived in the United States?
Well, we came in 1976. My father is a North Korean refugee, and he's a Korean refugee from the North, because when he was born, when he was a child, there was no such thing as North Korea. North Korea is a very new concept. It's basically not even a country, even 100 years old. So he came from the North, and he lost everything. So when he was working in the South, he had this terrible fear that the war would happen again. And actually, what's interesting is that most people who live in the South now miniaturizing nuclear warhead right now. You know, he's a little unstable. Anyhow, so in 76, I was 7 and a half, we came to this country, and we were kind of solid middle class in Korea, and then when we first came here, we were just, we were not middle class, we were definitely working class. I grew up very modestly in Queens, New York.
Tell about what your father did.
I didn't always wear a Downton Abbey outfit. Sorry. I'm sure your question was, I was like in my fashion moment there. Turned it around, like he cleaned it up first of all. My mother's like, we found so much grime, we couldn't believe how much grime there was in this thing. So they just went to bottles of Windex and they cleaned it. And my father got an ice cream machine, which the ice cream manufacturer actually donated. I mean, all these people who were working there before didn't really care. My father really wanted to succeed at this thing. And I loved it. Like, I loved the candy store.
Of course.
I was 7. I had never had a peppermint patty before. Very exciting. So I used to go to the store with him on the weekends. The things that I do remember, though, and he only had the store for 1 year, and then he switched to being a wholesale jeweler, is I do remember he wore a coat and tie every day, because he wore a coat and tie every day when he went to the office. And I do recall people throwing money at him when he bought a paper. And in Korea, that's a really terrible thing. So you'll always know a Korean from this one gesture. If I hand you something, a Korean person will always be two hands. No, you would just have to do it two hands.
Okay.
And that's a mutuality. Like, I could be your servant, and I could work for you, but that is very important. So the fact that someone can fling a dime at you for a deal you use, that's a big deal. And I saw that happen to my father quite a lot. Even as a little girl, I remember thinking, that was not cool.
I learned recently that you were diagnosed in high school with a liver disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, and I'm so glad that you're now completely cured.
I'm thinking well. Now, I'm very well.
But how did this affect you in your life as a writer?
Oh, I wouldn't have been a writer if I wasn't sick. Because I'm chicken. Like, the idea of poverty, of choosing poverty or not having money, is really not logical if you grew up lower middle class. But I think that because I was told so early and so often that I would die young, I'm fine. But I had it for about 20 years, and I got gradually more sick. That I thought that if I was going to have an early, demise, I thought that I would like to do something that was important. So I thought, I know, I'll write a book. But it took me 11 years to write my first book. I mean, to publish my first book.
Tell the story about when you went to the writers' conference and all the other people were on scholarships.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all the sad things today.
No, I'm teasing.
I wrote an essay in Lit Hub. So if anybody here is a writer and it's taking you a long time, if you want to feel better about yourself, read the essay. Because you're like, I'm not as big of a loser as indigenous. But you'll feel immediately better. So I thought, so right after I had my son, I nursed for a year, and I thought that for my big, big splurge, like, you know how people get push presents? Like, I got $1,000 and I got to go to Tennessee to go to this writer's conference called Swanee. And the Swanee Writers Conference was hard to get into, but then they have a tiering system. It's sort of like North Korea. And I was at the very, very bottom. So the top people go for free, and like if you're somewhat accomplished, like your name would be like Jeanette would go for free because it would be like Jeanette Watson, you know, scholar of Tennessee, William, blah blah, you know, blah. And she'd go, let's say, you know, like 10% off, and then you get up. You don't even have to pay like $50, and you go. I have to pay the whole thing. Which means you would just say, Minjin Lee, a lot of white space. And And I was really sad because I just finished nursing, so I was crying all the time, very emotional. And one day happened to be sitting with all these really super glamorous young people who have MFAs from Iowa.
It's kind of like sitting with Harvard Business School,
you know, the equivalent in the arts. And I just sort of sat there eating my little food, and there's very good coconut cake, by the way, there. Every go to one this coconut cake. And this young woman, very glamorous, very cool, started to make fun of all the housewives who had gone to this program, who had paid full freight like an idiot. And like I'm looking up at my coconut cake, like, she's talking about me. And like, I just die. And I just like went back to my little room and I was like crying some more. And I thought I made this humongous mistake. Because at the time, we didn't really have the extra money. And I felt so stupid because I hadn't written this book. So there is a happy ending. No, my favorite is when I used to go to these really nice parties and my husband would take me because he needed a date. And I'd meet all these glamorous people in New York and they would take me like, oh, so what are you doing? And I would say, well, I'm sort of working on a book. And they would go, oh, what kind of book? And I would say, fiction. And they just look at you and they go, well, I don't read fiction. And you just want to die. Like, you just want to die. So when you go to the bathroom again, you start to have a cry. And, you know, hopefully your husband takes you home.
Then we can go back, you know, really sad. But when you were
just funny now, but I think at the moment, like I just, you know, tragic. I should have called you, Jenna.
Yes. I've been there. When you were a child, what books did you like to read?
Oh, I love Dickens. So when I was first of all, I didn't know how to read or write or speak English. Because I came here when I was 7 and a half. So I pretty much learned how to do all those things at public libraries. So
did
that's,
your parents speak English?
Not really. My father learned English a little bit by running errands for GIs during the war. He's very good with languages, so he read a lot of dictionaries and he'd be able to sort of pick up things. Mm-hmm. So he speaks fluent Japanese and Korean, and he basically learned a little Russian and English from dictionaries. And my mother, she's very precise, so she doesn't like to speak because she doesn't want to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. So we grew up not talking, and then also I have this problem where I didn't really start talking until I was almost in high school. So this can be verified by my family. I took all these speaking classes because everybody's very worried about me.
Like Einstein didn't speak.
But yeah, that must be it.
Well, I noticed that Japan published Pachinko and gave it a good review, but not as glowing as I would.
Oh, I'm sorry, no, Japan Times wrote an article.
Oh, that was Japan Times.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry, no. Japan has not made an offer for this book.
Oh, because I got it.
Poland has.
So
was Turkey.
Have you heard anything from the Japanese?
No, but also, I got, I'm probably getting trouble because this is recorded, but I know. Korea actually made an offer. It was so low that I actually had to turn it down because I was worried about its budget. For translations. So it's not translated. I mean, I'm not going to fault the Japanese because the Koreans haven't come in either. Mm. But the book's doing great in Ireland. It's doing great in South Africa. I mean, it's so bizarre.
So it's been translated into all these different languages.
Well, it's actually the UK versions are sold in all these different Commonwealth places.
I see.
Former Commonwealth places. Wonderful.
Now, who are your favorite writers?
Oh, I think it's still very much George Eliot. Mm-hmm. My heart is devoted to her. And also, I love William Trevor, who lost him last year. Toni Morrison.
You like Juno?
I love Juno, yeah.
I do too.
Yeah. I mean, Juno is so smart and brave. I think for me, like, his architecture is really so brilliant, but also he's got this kind of courage in the things that he wants to say. And I think that's really, really hard to say some of the things. I just recommended a wonderful book by Jung Yun. There's a young writer right here, Marie Marquette, who's fantastic. She's right here.
We all had it. We all have trauma and shame.
You really bad so eloquently, but please let us know what you think.
I think what's interesting to me, especially about trauma, is that because the world, the past 20th and 21st century, we're having so much dislocation and so much trauma. Like right now, there's 65 million refugees in the world. That's a direct result of instability in governments. And what I find to be really interesting is how long does trauma take in order for it to rinse out? Like, I'm working on a very long essay for the Times Literary Supplement right now on North Korean literature, and I've had to study a lot about North Korea. And one of the things that they have in that interesting country is that if I do something bad and I get put away into a labor camp, my entire family and three generations are guilty of whatever I did. So if I bought a USB stick and it had Korean soap operas, which is forbidden, Christopher, my husband, my son Sam, and Sam's children are all guilty for three generations.
And so does everyone remember that and talk about it?
Well, you live in this political labor camp.
They're all living in it.
And if you kill yourself, then that's a crime too. You're not allowed to kill yourself in North Korea, because then your family gets punished. But I'm taking this as an idea of a state-held principle of three generations being necessary to suffer for your crime. My question, actually, for all of us is, let's say you had a family member survive, let's say, the Holocaust, the Vietnam War. What's going on in Syria? How long would it take for your children, to actually be able to function normally without that trauma being held in your body, in your cells, in your memory, in the way people treat each other? Like, because my father's a war refugee, we always had gold in the house, like literally like gold. Because he remembered that we need this thing in case currencies are worthless. So that was sort of interesting to me that he felt this need to do that. Like my parents actually have four refrigerators in the basement. That's not normal.
No.
I mean, I have great sympathy for my parents, especially my father, because he's really experienced hunger and having to take care of himself. But I do think that these things exhibit in a daily way well after the event. And how does that affect your children and your grandchildren?
You know, according to shamanism, if I study shamans, and they said it would be seven generations.
Seven.
That it would go back to seven generations ago, your family suffered shame. So you would stay on it, your bodies are in some way. So one of the things you learn is, you know, how to clear it, get rid of the generational shame.
I'm glad North Korea doesn't do that.
Yes.
A long time.
That is a really long time.
I know. But in the Hebrew Bible, seven is a number of completeness. I'm just curious, like, I wonder if that seven comes from different spaces across culturally, but why seven is such an important number. You could look at it sort of like in a W.E.B. Du Bois kind of way, which is that you can actually have an extra sense. Like the most positive way to look at being an outsider is you can say, I don't only just see with two eyes, I have a third eye, I have a third perspective. That would probably be the most positive way to look at it. Or you can walk around feeling like you don't see well at all. So when I talk to college students who read my first book, I often find that it's actually more the latter. Most kids walk around thinking that there's something wrong with them. They don't actually think, I have an additional perspective. I almost have to kind of rewind and go, no, you know how to do this, and you know how to do this. You're actually more adaptive. There's nothing wrong with you. And it's going to be a while, and sometimes like they may be born in a certain location in which other people don't see their uniqueness as a gift, but almost like there's something really wrong with you. Mm-hmm. So like if you're in New York and you're different, it can be seen as a huge plus.
Yeah.
But if you're not born in New York and you're somewhere else, it could be tough.
Yes. So you go around and you talk to college students?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. If they'll have me, yes.
That's wonderful. Oh, so your story is kind of a universal story about immigrants and struggling to adapt, and it's so relevant to what's happening in the world today at our recent treatment of Muslims. And would you please talk about that?
It's funny because I got the idea for this book in college. I went to a lecture that an American missionary had, and I didn't want to go. My friend asked me to come, and nobody wanted to go. Just think about it, you know. You're 19. Why would you want to go? But then I didn't want to go to my class more, so I went to the lecture. So I went to this lecture, this American missionary, a very nice white American man who worked with the Koreans in Japan, was talking about how horrible it is for the Koreans in Japan, and I was like, tell me another sad story. Because I was 19 and I thought I knew everything. And all of a sudden he talked about this one little boy in his parish who was 13 years old. And he climbed up to his apartment building and he jumped off to his death. And his parents were devastated. And they went through his things and they looked through everything. And they found his middle school yearbook in which his classmates had written, go back to where you belong, you smell like kimchi, and they wrote the words, die, die, die. And the boy did. And of course, the parents were born in Japan. The little boy was born in Japan. And that story really shook me. And I have a story still. It propelled me to write this book. I spent almost 28 years because of that story. But I have to tell you that the reason why I think that story disturbed me so much is because in my experience, as somebody who came to this country at 7 and a half, I've had nothing but encouragement from most Americans. Mm-hmm. Like, I've had Mr. Tarasko, my Ukrainian math teacher, who came in early and he helped me with math. Mr. Sosa's wrote my college recommendation. Like, these are all Americans who came in and said, I'm going to be behind her, and pushed me along and told me, go talk to this person, and this is what you should say, and afterwards write a thank you note. And they taught me all these things my parents couldn't have known, because they don't have the social norms of this country. And I think that the reason why that story was so disturbing to me is because I find it so hard to believe that there are people out there who could allow a social norm to hate children. Mm-hmm. Because I do think Americans love children, even children who aren't the majority. So I think there's a part of me that really protested this.
Yeah.
And again, when I was in Japan, most of my friends were Japanese. My husband is half Japanese. My son is a quarter Japanese. So I know for a fact it's not that it's the Japanese people per se who hate children. That's not true. It's just that there is a social norm in certain countries, most countries around the world, where they don't want to accept people who are not of their own blood. It's not just Japan. I mean, Koreans are very, very hard on people who are outside too. So that's something that people are all fight against.
Well, I was talking to a friend recently, not really a friend, but she was saying it's so important to have barriers, you know, here and in France, and keep all the, you know, immigrants out.
Is she here?
No, she's teasing.
Dinner that they had at this church is that everybody who served were American.
That's so interesting.
So if you see Japanese homeless people at this curry dinner at the Tokyo Union Church, you'll see homeless people wearing like Whistling Creek golf shirts. Why? Because some expatriate husband donated a shirt. And the homeless guy is wearing it. And you're kind of like, I don't get it. But it makes sense. And as a matter of fact, I think the history of American voluntarism is actually so long and so rich. It's very normal for Americans to think that on Thanksgiving to go out there and serve people. or to spend once a month, you know, teaching a poor kid. Like, that's very normal in America. It's not normal in other countries to help people who aren't related to you. So I think in that sense, there's a lot of reasons to feel very good about being American.
Well, thank you. Now I think it's time to open up the floor to questions. I'm sure people would like to ask.
And we have prizes.
We
actually have prizes because if you play pachinko, you get a prize.
Oh, good. Well, Lori,
yeah, I have a question. I just bought your book and I'm really excited about reading it.
Thank you for buying the book.
I'm very excited about it. But you mentioned how your teachers welcomed you. And do you, I don't feel very positive these days about welcoming anybody. New Yorkers or most places are much more generous. But I'm wondering, do you think that that was very unusual for you to be welcomed by these, and the people you were talking about sound like they had foreign names, so were they first generation Americans, second generation? Was it exceptional in your area? I think that in other parts of this country, people even 2 decades ago, whatever, were not welcoming other foreigners, whether they were blood or not, because you don't look like me, so therefore, why should I help you?
I actually, I have to tell you that I've had so many people be kind to me who aren't white Anglo-Saxon Protestants too. So unfortunately, I can't say that what I see in the headlines reflects the America that I've experienced. Do I believe that there are people in Iowa and Ohio who would like to see me gone? Sure. I can't reach them. But I do believe that Senator Clinton did win the popular vote. So even though we have this bizarre electoral college, which is not going to go away, I actually do believe that most Americans are far more decent than most people that I've met around the world in terms of helping strangers. I do.
I agree.
Yeah. So, but I do share your sense of disappointment and sadness at the hostility that is being expressed towards those who are different. I broke down recently because these South Asian engineers were murdered in California. But I do think that was an exception, not the rule. But you get it. I just want to share this with you. It's actually my friend. And I just want to mention it because she is a woman who owns a company who makes phone cleaners. And she has 2 boys, just like my main character. And she read the book, and she made these for me. She goes, I'm only going to make you 90 because they're so expensive. And she said, I want you to share them with readers. So whoever's brave enough to ask a question, you can. Okay, I think there's a, I'm sorry, go ahead. I wrote an entire manuscript before 2007. Like, it was about 450 pages. But I never asked to publish it because it wasn't very good. And I'm not being modest. It was actually kind of like a weak history book. It was not a novel. I think that I didn't actually know how to tell the story then. This was in 1996. So I put that book aside and then I wrote Papers to Millionaires. My third novel became my first published book. And then in 2007, my husband got this fancy job, so we went to Tokyo. And then I didn't want to go to live there because I really love being in New York. And I didn't want to miss my family. But once I was there, I told myself, well, I'm going to do all this research. So I got to interview so many Korean Japanese people because once somebody says she's okay, then all of a sudden, like, the doors just start open. I don't know if you know this, but right now, if you're ethnically Korean in Japan, you have actually 3 choices of citizenship. You're either South Korean, even though you've never been there. You're either North Korean, which means you can't travel because there's no diplomatic relationship between the country of North Korea and Japan, you have a card, but you're a permanent resident. And or you can become a Japanese citizen, which means you're naturalized. However, the Japanese people will never, ever, ever think that you're Japanese. So for example, after Donald Trump won, Masa Son, the owner of SoftBank, came to this country. You might have seen pictures of him shaking hands with Donald Trump in front of Trump Tower's escalator. And he said, I'm going to invest all this money, and Brian, you can tell me how much that was, in America, and I'm going to rejuvenate America. And every newspaper in the West said, a Japanese businessman, the owner of SoftBank, came to America and will reinvigorate the American economy. There isn't one person in Japan who would say that Masa Son is Japanese. So you could be a Japanese citizen, but in Japan, you're still Korean. And with that come all the negative connotations, because Koreans are supposed to be lazy, criminal, unreliable, aggressive, and untrustworthy, et cetera, et cetera. Especially the criminal aspect, that comes up quite a bit. But here, how about here? I'm sorry, I'm rusty.
I want to first pass my phone here to the next person.
You really don't want this, really? You need somebody perhaps who needs a phone here.
I love the book, and I was very struck by the opening and how much it won me as a thriller.
Oh, I love Hardy. I absolutely love Hardy.
So I wonder if you would just.
I even like. Jude the Obscure. That's how much Hardy I like. I know. It's so good. I know. I love Hardy.
I know.
I'm sorry, talk to me. Go ahead.
Anyway, I just wondered, and you talked about Dickens, I just wonder if you could spend a moment saying, you know, how that classical literature, how that influenced the book.
Oh, you know, it's really funny because I always talk about all the authors that I like, and people are like, oh, you mean really all the classics, all the greats.
Yeah,
and I always just think, actually, those guys knew how to plot. So if you find when you read Pachinko and you can keep going, it's because I learned how to plot. Mm-hmm. And I learned how to plot from those guys who actually wrote for newspapers. Mm-hmm. All the 19th century authors wrote for newspapers. They have to sell a newspaper every week. They're paid by the word. I don't get paid by the word. I wish I were. I know. I see these authors coming out with these 175-page books, and they charge $27. And I read this 500-page book, and I'm like, Charlotte Bronte, I think Jane Eyre is my favorite book in the entire planet. It's right up there because Jane is my girl. Are you sure you don't want to come?
I'm sure. I might get more smart.
That you can actually make a difference. You don't just like sort of sit there, you have to kind of hold a dial. And I wasn't doing it very well, so this sort of older gentleman, very friendly, he put his hand over mine and kind of helped me do the thing. But I ended up winning 15,000 yen, which is a lot of money. It's like 150 bucks now, sort of. But I think that the owner was controlling it and wanted me to win. I do. I actually think that was not a fair thing. So I didn't actually play again. I just kept But it's not the sort of thing that I would like because I'm very comfortable in quiet spaces. I'm an introvert that can perform to be polite. So I really need things to be quiet all the time. So it's really hard for me to be around a lot of noise. But I do think that when I interview people who love to play pachinko, they told me that they love the noise. They actually love the din of it because Japan is so quiet, as you know. Mm. Like when I used to be on the subway in Tokyo, I used to think everybody's depressed. Like, if you actually said anything too loud, people would have. So I thought that must be the contrast. People live in smaller spaces. Perhaps they want to be intimate, but not intimate. And there's a lot of different explanations we can say why people love pachinko. But I don't know if you know this, but it's a $203 billion business. So it's twice the export revenues of the Japanese auto industry. And they make cars like Toyota, Nissan, and Honda. So it is actually a big chunk of the Japanese economy. One out of 11 people in Japan play weekly. And it is dominated in terms of ownership by the Korean Japanese.
We only have time for one more question. Oh, we have a question back there.
Somebody who taught a lot of Japanese women who were wives of businessmen here in New York who taught them English found that when their husbands' terms were up and these women had to go back with their husbands to Japan, most of them were very sorry to leave a place where they had a lot more freedom to do whatever they pleased and didn't feel that they were being watched by their mothers-in-law or anybody else in society. While you were in Japan, what did you see about the sense that women had about their own place, and did you see any difference between the pure Japanese and the Japanese Korean women and the two cultures that they had each grown up with?
Oh, that's really an interesting question, because you're really asking a question about gender.
Yes.
Right. And one of the things that was really interesting for me is that in my life in New York, I actually have male friends and colleagues, and it's not in any way romantic. And people actually, like, if you go to a dinner, it's not just women, it's not just men. You can actually have mixed groups. Like, you could have 6 women and 4 men, and you can just have a common interest. In Japan, it was incredibly segregated all the time. So even if you were an expatriate, very often it was very segregated. And that was really weird because I work, but I also identify with stay-at-home mothers. I really feel like that's really most of what I do anyway, wash dishes. So I thought that was really difficult for me. But in terms of, do Korean Japanese women feel that they can behave differently than Japanese women? No. The reason why I say that is because usually outsiders want to be even better than the insiders. And one of my characters, Noah, he really suffers from this, in which he tries so very hard to be a good Japanese. And it's not possible to be a good Japanese if you're not Japanese. So, can you be a good Japanese woman if you're a Korean Japanese woman? The answer is absolutely no. So what do most people do? They still try to do it. So if a good Japanese mom of a kindergarten child was volunteering 4 times a week because she was supposed to volunteer 3 times, I noticed that the Korean Japanese mothers do the exact same thing. So it wasn't me less. It wasn't like I had more freedom. Like, I think that's sort of the way maybe I would approach it. I would do less. I don't think I would try to be outdoing somebody because, I mean, I don't know how other outsiders feel, but in New York, you're allowed to have integrity about your background. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things about being in New York is that I can say, I grew up working class in Elmhurst, Queens, and I can also be the society library. All those things are possible. I can visit these worlds in which I don't necessarily belong, and that's okay. Whereas I think to talk like that in other countries, it's very threatening and weird. So, I hope that answered it.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you all for coming. And can we have copies of the book?
Here.
Just prop them against the wall there if you don't mind. That's perfect. Thank you.